Interventionism is not only immoral and aggressive, it doesn't work. We must regain liberty at home, end all interventions in other countries, and return to the historic forgotten foreign policy of serving as an example and beacon light of liberty to the rest of the suffering and strife-torn world. Welcome to Keith Knight, Don't Tread on Anyone. Today we have Scott Horton of the Libertarian Institute and antiwar.com. Scott, thank you for your time.
Hey man, happy to be here as always, Keith. How are you doing, buddy?
I'm doing excellent. I was reading Obama's book. Let's get through it, starting with Afghanistan.
Wait, check it out.
Oh,
I just got proofs in the mail today. See, not for resale. That's the brand new edit version for me to look through here.
I didn't know we were making the announcement yet. Terrific. Enough already.
So I'm hoping to publish on the 16th, but I probably will not make that deadline. But I'm trying. I'm working real hard on it now, and as are a lot of other people helping me with the copy editing and everything.
Terrific. Can't wait to have you back on for that one. So Enough Already is the title, coming out very soon.
Oh, yeah.
Starting with Obama, A Promised Land, page 440.
I'm sorry. I'm just laughing at that cover. Oh, what a nice man.
He is. Huh? They caught him smiling. What are the chances? Okay. Page 440, Afghanistan. 6 days earlier, 300 Afghan militants had overrun a small U.S. military outpost in the Hindu Kush, killing 8 of our soldiers and wounding 27 more. October would become the deadliest month for U.S. troops in Afghanistan since the start of the war 8 years earlier. And rather than ushering a new era of peace, I was facing the prospect of committing more soldiers to war. Unfortunately, the previous president, he makes clear, could have gotten Afghanistan taken care of, but he was distracted with Iraq. Afghanistan is a place we need to be for national security purzposes and to make sure the Karzai government was stable. Therefore, Obama's foreign policy of sending more troops to Afghanistan was justified. How do you respond?
Well, he knows that he's lying when he writes that garbage. The war was lost before he was ever sworn in, and he knew it. And he ran on, exactly as you said, that narrative. That, well, see, Bush got distracted and diverted all of our resources off to Iraq. And if he hadn't done that, then the war in Afghanistan would have gone great. So now to correct that error, we're going to escalate the war. However, that was really just a BS narrative. He was only going to send a couple of brigades and then bring them home in another couple of years, basically, as a Democrat politician might. But then he got in there. And once he got in there, came the full court press from the Pentagon that what you're going to do is you're going to give us 60,000 more troops, really ended up being 70,000 more troops. He ended up giving them throughout the year of 2009 and culminating in the final escalation of the 30. And you always hear him say, yeah, he sent 30,000 more. Yeah, he sent 30,000 more after he sent 40,000 more, you know. And he knew that they were rolling him, and he gave in to the pressure. You know, I hate to quote Bob Woodward books all the time, but frankly, because it's always very establishment narrative. But on the other hand, yeah, because he's talking to the principals, he's getting, you know, he's interviewing the people who are directly involved in it. So, you know, whether they're being disingenuous or not, sometimes it's beside the point. You just get to see the window, you know, through their eyes. So one of the things that they talked about in that book, in his book, Obama's Wars, which is not about Obama's wars at all. It's about the bureaucratic war in D.C. in the year 2009, trying to force Obama to escalate Afghanistan. That's what the whole book is about. I don't know why they called it that. But anyway, everybody knew, right, that the Pentagon and the Secretary of Defense, their job is to say, Mr. President, let's quadruple down, right? And then the State Department's job is to say, well, I don't think so. Why don't we do less? And then that way Obama can say, well, you know, I have this other opinion. But in Obama's war council, of course, his Secretary of State was Hillary Clinton. So Hillary Clinton says, gee, boss, I think you better do what they say. And then this is in the telling of Robert Gates and Leon Panetta, who was the CIA guy, and I guess, General Petraeus, too, that in their own view, they were the hawks. Especially Gates and Petraeus, they were the hawks. But even to them, they thought that this was just so horrible and cynical of Hillary Clinton to do this to Barack Obama. where she was, as they put, I think this was Gates's words, that she was narrowing his running room and leaving him leaving him no one to side with, basically, right? Leaving him fewer people in his administration to say that, well, I sided with the Doves over the Hawks because they're just nothing but Hawks. And then, so he was the only people who backed the minimal position, relatively minimal, that is, position, was the vice president, then Joe Biden, and Douglas Lute, who was a general, the war czar that Obama had inherited from George W. Bush. And they both didn't want to escalate, but that wasn't enough, basically. Hillary, if she had really joined their side, maybe it would have been enough. But so in November 2009, Obama rolled over. He gave them everything that they wanted. But it's so clear from not just Woodward, but from all the reporting at that time, that Obama didn't believe in all this claptrap about counterinsurgency doctrine and how we're going to win the hearts and minds of the people of the thing. And Joe Biden at the time was like, look, we should murder any Arab we can find there. Fine. But why are we fighting the Taliban? That's stupid, dude. What are we doing? We shouldn't even try to win over the people of the primarily Pashtun regions of Afghanistan, the south and the east of the country. We should just make sure that there's no real bad guys who threaten us there. And then that's it. So I'm not saying I'm for that, but that was the minimal version of the, it was still an escalation. He wanted 40,000, not 70 or whatever it was, right? He still was bad on it. But he was saying the mission should be limited to making sure that the Kabul government doesn't fall, making sure there's no Al-Qaeda guys there. Instead, it's funny because the Pentagon pushed on Obama. The policy that you just read to me is him pretending was his idea that he wanted to do was the thing that they made him do. Yeah, well, we had to promise to, you know, make sure not just to keep the Kabul government from falling, but we have to build it into a great new stable democratic thing that'll last for the ages. And, you know, we got to go and do, I forgot the rest of the quote there, but essentially we got to go and take it to the bad guys, broadly defined to mean the locals, not transnational, international Arab terrorists, but the people who are fighting to get us off of their own front lawn, as Obama knew good and well. And we're not talking about George W. Bush or Donald Trump, the complete dumb here. You know, Obama knew enough to be as self-aware as any person could be at the wrong that he was committing when he was committing it. No question about it.
On page 320, he talks about the Rydell plan, saying, our principal goal to disrupt and dismantle and defeat Al-Qaeda in Pakistan and Afghanistan and to prevent their return to either country in the future. The report added emphasis on Pakistan was key. Not only did the Pakistani military, and particular its intelligence arm, ISI, tolerate the presence of Taliban headquarters and leadership in Quetta near Pakistani border, but it was also quietly assisting the Taliban as a means of keeping the Afghan government weak and hedging against Kabul's potential alignment with Pakistani arch rival, India.
Sounds like you've been reading fool's errand, huh?
Well, two more sentences. That the U.S. government had long tolerated such behavior from a purported ally, supporting it with billions of dollars in military and economic aid, despite its complicity with violent extremists and its record as a significant and irresponsible proliferator of nuclear weapons technology in the world, said something about the pretzel-like logic of U.S. foreign policy. Al-Qaeda has gone from Afghanistan to Pakistan. We got to fight them over there before they come over here. How do you respond?
Well, I mean, just putting the dot on the end of my sentence there about how this man is absolutely self-aware about the nuance of this stuff. Unlike a couple of real ne'er-do-well presidents we've had recently, this one can read books. Okay. But so what he's saying about Pakistan is right. Pakistan backs the Afghan Taliban to prevent the Kabul government that Bush and Obama were installing in power there from creating a true monopoly on force there in alliance with Pakistan's arch rival to their southeast, India. And so they don't want to be hemmed in by India and India's ally in Afghanistan. So they got to back the Taliban there to keep that from happening. Well, that's been their policy since 2005 and it works. And what can the Americans do about it? Nothing. And what's going to make the Pakistanis back down from that policy? Nothing. And then what do the Americans do? as I know, I'm sure you laughed out loud reading Fool's Errand, the Americans continue to ask the Indians to intervene even more to help the Afghan government resist the Taliban that the Pakistanis keep backing for the very reason that we keep asking the Indians to come in and help prop up the government in Kabul. And the whole thing is just a perpetual motion machine. Of course, you know, fueled by the American people's money. But otherwise, it just keeps going around and around and around. And then at the same time, this is the same Pakistani government then that he allied with and helped them launch this massive war against the Pakistani Taliban. And this is like a kind of a trade-off, like a compromise. If you let us do our CIA drone war to kill Al-Qaeda guys in Pakistan, then we'll help you wage your war against the Pakistani Taliban, which had never threatened us and wasn't a problem for us. And as a result of that, the Pakistani Taliban tried to blow up Times Square in 2010. You might remember Faisal Shahzad and the failed plot at Times Square. Luckily, his bomb didn't go off, but he was sent there by the Pakistani Taliban to do that. Well, they'd never targeted us before. They have no beef with us. They probably never heard of the New World before until Obama started helping their government bomb the hell out of them up there in Waziristan, the Swat Valley, and the federally administered tribal territories there. And then, of course, another major part of the blowback from Obama's war in Pakistan was that the Tariqi Taliban guys fled across the border to Afghanistan for safe haven. Just like the Afghan Taliban hide in Pakistan, the Pakistani Taliban came to hide in Afghanistan. And then guess what? I know you'll be surprised and amazed and won't believe me when I tell you that the CIA and the Afghan government recruited them for a little bit of payback against the Pakistanis. How would you like it if we start backing the Pakistani Taliban, taking safe haven on this side of the border, and they start doing attacks on your side of the border, and see how you like that? Because all the American CIA, they're really clever guys. They know what to do. And then they also said, you know, we could use these guys, these new Pakistani guys, maybe we could use them against the Afghan Taliban too. Started giving them some money, some training. Next thing you know, they hoist the black flag and call themselves ISIS, the Islamic State in the Khorasan province. And they're now the whole new safe haven myth, the whole new excuse to stay is, well, okay, we haven't seen any Arabs in like 20 years, but these Pakistanis in Afghanistan and the few Afghan Taliban guys who've gone to their cause, they call themselves ISIS. And so that's, and those are the head chopper guys. You remember them. So that's enough to keep us at war. And that's the narrative in Washington, D.C. And so, and you know, and all this is Obama's fault. Never had to be this way at all. And he could have told, listen, Obama said, look, I can't look weak. Rahm Emanuel told him, I know that's in the book. Rahm Emanuel told him, you can't look weak. Well, doesn't it look weak to roll over for your, for David Petraeus, you know, who does nothing but lose wars? Who, you know, why not be a tough guy by facing down the hawks? Oh, you want to resign over my refusal to escalate, huh? How about this? You're fired for trying to force me to escalate a war that I already know is stupid and that I know that you know is stupid, Mr. Don't have enough stars and want another one. So screw you, you know? And then he would have been the alpha dog. Then he would have been the tough guy, only doing the right thing instead of the wrong thing. And instead, and this is in my book, and I think I got this from Woodward, but I think it was somewhere else too, that that Rahm Emanuel met with Lindsey Graham, and Lindsey Graham, on behalf of himself and John McCain, said, give us a number that starts with a 3, meaning another 30,000 something troops, and we promise that we'll shut up. And that's exactly what happened. That was the deal that they made. They shook hands. They gave him the 30,000 troops. Why? To help the Afghan people? No, so that Lindsey Graham and John McCain would be quiet in the Senate. Explicit. It's just for politics. For a war that Obama knew he couldn't win. Knew counterinsurgency was wrong. You know, that's amazing listening to him, you know, his justification for this. That guy's a sociopath on the level of Bill Clinton. Listen to you read that, the memoirs. Just incredible.
So you are confident that even though there's a group, Al-Qaeda, who hates America and has no problem killing civilians, we don't have to be invading Afghanistan and Pakistan to have national security. Is that your position?
Yeah, of course not. Look, the reason Al-Qaeda attacked us is because we have bases in Saudi Arabia. In fact, speaking of Lindsey Graham, Lindsey Graham's like, this whole occupation theory is crazy. we weren't occupying Afghanistan before September 11th. Yeah, but it wasn't Afghans who attacked us, was it? It was Saudis and Egyptians. You know, Egyptians, where we backed the military dictatorship for 30 years up until then. You know, the Saudi Arabia, where we backed the royal monarchy for 75 years in their rulership over, you know, their monarchy. Is I'm an American, you're an American. Do I need to elaborate? Do I need to explain that that is means inherently, absolutely illegitimate? You know, like the place is run by witch doctors or something, right? This is, you don't have the right to rule these people. You call yourself a king. You're not royal at all. You're scum. That's all Americans agree about that, except in Washington, D.C. You know, go ahead.
I was just going to say, if people want more info on that, the first chapter of Fool's Errand is terrific, along with Dying to Win by Robert Pape, really gets into the history and legitimacy of blowback. Are there any good blowback books, yours being the best, Robert Pape's being a close second? Are there any more that I'm not remembering that are just vital to knowing?
I go over a lot of the same material in the new book, because I think, as you remember, the Afghanistan book, that was really chapter one and chapter two of this book.
Yeah.
It kind of accidentally turned into a book about Afghanistan because I couldn't keep chapter two at chapter length. So I reappropriated a lot of that same material from chapter one. So all that'll be in enough already. But, you know, a classic recommended by Osama bin Laden himself is Imperial Hubris, Why America is Losing the War on Terrorism by Michael Scheuer. It's, you know, on Amazon.com, it's by Anonymous, because when it came out, the CIA still insisted that he keep his identity secret. But this was the chief of the CIA's bin Laden unit. And the book was written in 2004. And I should say, because I want to say, that he's a total piece of garbage now. He's gone completely crazy and, you know, talks about, you know, he'd like to see every last Muslim all die in one big civil war. We ought to fund both sides till they're all dead, or just whatever, like total nuke them all, turn the Middle East to glass kind of right-wing crap. But he used to say wise things about how our government got us into this mess. And if you read 2004 era Michael Scheuer and that book, Imperial Hubris, that is absolutely, well, there's just no question. And he says, listen, yes, they are Islamist radicals, but that's not why they do what they do to us. They attack us because, not because of who we are, not because we're free or white or Christian or North American or innocent or brave. They attack us because we support their dictators and because we have military bases next to their most holy sites that we use to carpet bomb the neighboring country next door.
Yes. And of course,
and we back the Israeli occupation of Lebanon and Palestine as well.
And primary sources, bin Laden's 1998 letter, along with his letter in like 2000 letter to the Americans. So
96. That, yeah, there's the 1996 declaration of war against the Americans occupying the land of the two holy places. Pretty subtle, huh? And then the second one was the declaration of war against the international jihad against Jews and crusaders. And both of those are just absolutely explicit. And then, as you mentioned, there's the letter to America from 2002. There's the speech that he gave in 2004. And in fact, there's a whole book. I read a whole book one time of just all collected bin Laden speeches and stuff from all through the 1990s. And, you know, there's also a really great book called The Secret History of Al-Qaeda by Abdel Bari Atwan. And he's the publisher and editor of Al-Quds Al-Arabi, the newspaper in Britain. And he went and interviewed bin Laden for 3 days in like 1998 or 1999 in Afghanistan, I think. And man, it's just all in there, bro. I don't know what to tell you. Read it and weep.
There's so much in there. That's where I learned about Iraqi sanctions, which I'd never heard about previously. So continuing on with Barack Obama, page 580, he's talking about how difficult it was to close Guantanamo Bay, and he says, in fact, the largest contingent, 99 men, from Guantanamo, was from Yemen, a dirt poor country with a barely functioning government, deep tribal conflicts, and the single most active Al-Qaeda chapter outside Pakistani's federally administered tribal areas, FATA. He goes on to mention Yemen for the last time, page 624. Yemen, one of the world's true hard luck cases, has become headquarters to Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, which was now the deadliest and most active chapter of the terrorist network. We are only in Yemen to fight Al-Qaeda, who has already killed us, partially out of revenge we're getting them, and to deter further attacks. Therefore, intervention in Yemen, along with the Saudis, is morally justified. How do you respond?
Do I understand you right? You're saying that the last thing that you read there was his final reference to Yemen?
And so I'm going to have to go through this again, but I didn't remember it, so I went to the index, and Yemen only comes up twice. I think you are asked.
And now, and so is there a year in that passage that you just read to me? Is there a year or a kind of time reference there? I'm sorry?
At the end of 2010 on page 624. Yeah, Yemen is mentioned twice, 581 and 624.
And you're saying when he's talking there about killing Al-Qaeda there, this is in 2010, or he's referring to the 2010 era there and nothing after that?
If at the
there you go. 10, know, again, with the, you know what? If Donald Trump made an oversight in his memoir, I probably would not think that was necessarily dishonest. But for Barack Obama to just forget that he started the war in Yemen and to leave that out of this book is just, it just goes to show that he's essentially a psychopath, right?
Well, it could be one of these bait and switches. He mentions the year 2010 and then mentions Yemen. So technically he didn't say, you know, when it actually started, would say we had 9/11 and we had to go into Iraq.
Yeah.
Okay, they didn't explicitly say it, but they're intentionally lying.
Right. Well, and look, no, you made it clear, though, in that passage that you read that this is strictly a reference to the CIA effort against Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. And he's not mentioning, what he's not mentioning at all, is the entirely other, different, separate war that he launched there with Saudi Arabia in 2015, which is not the same war at all, as I know you know. It's the war for Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula, who are tight allies and serve in the militia of the United Arab Emirates in alliance with Saudi Arabia and the United States against their enemies, the Shiite Houthis. So this is like George W. Bush writing a memoir where he forgets to mention that he backed the Ethiopian invasion of Somalia, and it just doesn't fit in there. And in fact, I never read Bush's memoir. I'm willing to bet Somalia is not in there. And this is essentially equivalent to that. That, you know, oh, yeah, Yemen. Yeah, that's where I fought Al-Qaeda there for a few years early in my administration. And never mind the last 2 years of it at all. Never mind. We knew it would be long, bloody, and indecisive, but we felt we had to placate the Saudis for political reasons.
And you're roughly quoting from a quote from Obama in the New York Times?
Yeah, or his staff anyway, talking to the New York Times, yeah. In fact, I have another quote coming out in the new book. I found a quote of one of the Obama officials saying, look, we didn't do this because we thought it would be good for Yemen in any way, the people of Yemen. We did this for the good of U.S.-Saudi relations.
Yeah.
This started a war.
I haven't checked antiwar.com. Do you know what the casualties are in Yemen between the bombings and the sanctions?
Well, no, I mean, I think nobody knows. The most recent UN numbers are almost 250,000, but that would be like a year and a half ago. ACLED data, let's see, I do have this from recently. It was almost a year ago. It would have been early 2020. ACLED data, I should double check and see if they have an update, actually. They had it that there was 100,000 and change had been killed directly in violence. And then I think another 100,000 or so, I forgot exactly the proportions, had died of deprivation from the war, essentially, you know, casualties of war in the broader sense. But I'm telling you now that that doesn't scratch the surface, because you got people dying of malnutrition and of easily curable diseases. You know, someone gets a common cold and drops dead. So they're completely malnourished and have no ability to fight off disease. They have no clean drinking water. There have been thousands and thousands of deaths from cholera. There were some exaggerated reports that 1 million people have died of cholera, or 1 million people have it, and tens of thousands dying, or hundreds of thousands dying. That was all exaggerated. But still, it's thousands and thousands of people in the worst cholera outbreaks. And this is from having filthy water, because the Americans and the Saudis bombed their sewage and bombed their waterworks and bombed their electricity, stole their central bank and moved it down to Aden so that to cut off all the salaries of all the government employees. So there's no, you know, all the garbage men, all the civil servants, all the people that work at the sewage and the waterworks and the electricity can't be paid to do their jobs. So they have to go and try to find work elsewhere and what have you. And all this stuff stays broken. They bomb the hospitals. They bomb the fishermen. When this is all over, we're going to find that it's 500,000 minimum dead civilians in this thing, man. It's a genocide. It's a deliberate. See, you know, you can do a hell of a war against Iraq. But, well, I mean, actually, what's comparable here is after Iraq War One, you know, where during Iraq War One, they deliberately bombed the sewage and the electricity and the waterworks and then put them under blockade. But like, I guess my comparison was going to be to Iraq War Two, where we got 1 million people killed on this crazy mission, you know, as set up by, you know, Rice and Rumsfeld and whoever to put these factions and then those factions and whatever, you know, trying to negotiate that war. And you could say it amounted to a genocide. You could say with a, you know, I just interviewed Kelly Vallejos about the absolute horror show that is Iraq right now. I mean, their society has been completely destroyed. But it wasn't launched as a genocide. It was just launched as a stupid premeditated murder plot of a few thousand people. You know, it wasn't supposed to be like this, you know, total catastrophe. But in Yemen, it was. In Yemen, the purpose of the war is to kill innocent people. The purpose of the war is to starve them out, you know, to riddle them with disease to the point that then what? Somehow they're going to overthrow their government so that their government stops making America and Saudi Arabia mad at them, which is completely stupid and wrong. And it'll never work in 1 million years. It hasn't worked in 6 years, Keith. And they're starving people to death. And, you know, they deliberately bomb the farms. We've talked about this. They bomb the grain silos. They bomb the irrigation ducts and the flocks of sheep in the field and the trucks, the fishermen. The horses and whatever livestock they have, whatever they can. And then, in fact, there's a whole, I just found this the other day. There's a whole Human Rights Watch report targeting businesses where they're going, they're like, I don't know what they're looking in the phone book for the city of Sada in North Yemen. And they're just looking in the white pages at who all's got a successful business and their address. And they're just bombing them, just trying to completely destroy. I'm ad-libbing the last part there about the phone book, you get it, but they're just trying to destroy every successful business that they can on the ground, just completely eradicate the economic life of the civilian population of the country. It's absolutely savage, barbarian, medieval siege warfare and illegal under all the Geneva Conventions. And you know who says so? State Department lawyers in Obama and Trump's government have written up memos saying, boss, I'm afraid we could all go to prison for this, because they are under the delusion that the law applies to them, but they know what the law is. And the law says that it's against the law to do this. There's an American War Crimes Act that makes it a felony to participate in these things. And that, you know, just like they said in Syria, well, that's why it has to be covert, because we know it's illegal. Yeah, they're traitors. And they're murderers.
That's terrible. I look forward to reading the book. I know there's a chapter on Yemen, because that's one I got to read two or three times to really get to the bottom. Page 652. In Syria, the March 2011 arrest and torture of 15 schoolboys who had sprayed anti-government graffiti on city walls set off major protests against the Assad dominated regime in many of the country's predominantly Sunni communities after tear gas Water cannons, beatings, and mass arrests failed to quell the demonstrations. Assad's security forces went on to launch full-scale military operations across several cities, complete with live fire, tanks, and house-to-house searches. In 2011, no one questioned our limited influence in Syria. That would come later. He finishes this section by asking, but what if governments start massacring not hundreds of its citizens, but thousands, and the United States has the power to stop it? Then what? So, because of the crimes of Bashar al-Assad against innocent civilians, the U.S. big military had to step in on behalf of the citizens to stop the tyrant Assad. How do you respond?
I really dislike this Barack Obama guy. I mean, first of all, that's not true. Second of all, this makes me just... God, we're just about, I swear to you, I keep saying this to everybody. I can't stop thinking this. I feel like it's already been the Biden years for like 3 years. And it's not even sworn in yet.
You feel.
And like, oh God, the sanctimony of these Democrats. I just can't stand it. You know, just go ahead and admit to me you're lying and just lie. It doesn't have to be packaged with all this emotional crap, you know? So listen. Yes, the Assad regime did use violence against the protests, but the protesters used violence against the Assad regime, too. And, you know, what if there were, for example, the cop that died from the Wednesday thing in Washington, D.C.? Well, we only found out he died this morning, right? Or yesterday it came out that he died. But, like, what if all those right-wing Trump people had come and started killing cops, a bunch of them? Then what do you think? I mean, they would have pushed Trump aside probably at that point. The rest of the Washington, D.C. government would have used far more than necessary force to eradicate that mob from being anywhere near their precious white marble institutions. The American government would use ultimate violent force to put down any attempt to... you know, overthrow their government or commit violence against their security forces who are protecting their institutions. Well, it's true that there were peaceful protesters, moderate protesters, democratic reform-minded people, leftists and socialists, and who knows, maybe even libertarians, I don't know, out there protesting, wanting to be free. But there were also jihadists killing cops. And so what happens is the cops overreact to that. And this isn't to justify anything. And as far as I know, that story of the torture of those boys is correct in Derna there. And there was a lot of that. But, you know, Sharmeen Narwani has written about this at length in the American Conservative magazine. And a great journalist named William Van Wagenen has written about this at my website. The Libertarian Institute has done incredible research on this, showing that from the very beginning of the protests, there were some people on the margins were committing acts of violence against the cops and soldiers. And then that makes everything worse. The government, of course, continued to clamp down, and the people then react worse and get more radicalized. But then here's what's missing in this whole narrative, man. Al-Qaeda in Iraq coming across the border from Iraq to take over this thing. And Barack Obama, Saudi Arabia, Turkey, Qatar, and Israel, Jordan, all working together to back these jihadists. He says, oh, our barely limited intervention beyond saying something in 2011. Yeah. That's a damn lie. And I know it, and he knows it, and it's proven in my book. It's proven online right now. You can see all over the place where, in fact, John Hanna, who worked for Dick Cheney, wrote in, I'm almost certain, Keith, that it was in April of 2011 that Prince Bandar is back in charge of the intelligence division over there in Saudi Arabia, and he's emptying the jails and sending terrorists off to fight in Syria. And look, we're talking about, we still had troops in 2011. We still had troops in Iraq, right? Iraq War II wasn't even all the way over yet. But we're supposed to forget that if Saudi is sending fighters off to join the insurgency, that means Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That means the bad guys, that we're not even quite all the way done fighting, just on the other side of the border from Saudi right now in Iraq, right? That moment. And then for the rest, we had Alistair Crook, and we got Eric Margolies, and we've got John Bradley in Foreign Affairs, and we got Philip Giraldi in Antiwar.com, and we got now lead to the Stratfor email that shows that at Stratfor, they were talking about this at the end of December 2011. America, Britain, French special operations forces on the ground, spies on the ground, money, Saudis and Qataris sending weapons and sending dollars, and it's on. And so they want to say that this was all generated by Bashar al-Assad. No, it wasn't. It was a foreign invasion of American-backed al-Qaeda terrorists. That's who it was. Obama-backed al-Qaeda terrorists.
He goes on to sort of draw this pattern that there was uprisings in Tunisia, uprisings in Egypt, and then other Middle Eastern dictators got a little intimidated about the uppity populace going into Gaddafi in Libya. He says that the beginning of Gaddafi's regime decades ago, he had been ruthlessly efficient in stamping out dissent in his country, using a combination of secret police, security forces, state-sponsored militia to jail, torture, and murder anyone who dared to oppose him. Later, he talks about the arrest of a human rights lawyer by Gaddafi. This gave rise to protests, which Gaddafi accused of being fronts for al-Qaeda. Gaddafi unleashed a campaign of terror declaring everything will burn. By the beginning of March, the death count had risen to 1,000. I called for him to relinquish power, arguing that he had lost legitimacy to govern. We imposed economic sanctions, froze billions of dollars that belonged to his family at the United Nations Security Council. We passed an arms embargo. They were referred to in the International Criminal Court as illegitimate, he says. He asked himself, how many more people have to die before we take this one step? He finishes by saying, we were trying to prevent a massacre in Libya while minimizing the risk, to give the Libyan people an opportunity to engineer a new government. And then he summarizes the results. March ended without a single U.S. casualty in Libya and for an approximate cost of $550 million, not more than what we spent per day on military operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. We had accomplished our objective of saving Benghazi and its neighboring cities, perhaps tens of thousands of lives. According to Samantha, it was the quickest international military intervention to prevent a mass atrocity in modern history. What would happen with regard to Libya's government remained unclear, with Gaddafi ordering further attacks even in the face of NATO bombing operations and with the opposition fueled by a loose coalition of rebel militias. Gaddafi commits atrocities, therefore the U.S. was rightfully going in to stop the atrocities from continuing. How do you respond?
You know, I'm confused because I could have swore at the beginning of that passage he was going to talk about that was why he moved to help overthrow the royal family in Saudi Arabia and in Bahrain because they restrict the rights of the people there and use violence. In Saudi Arabia, you know what they do to their Shiite dissidents? They cut their heads off and then crucify their headless corpses to set an example. That's what happens when you stick your neck out for a little bit of justice and fairness in Saudi Arabia. In Bahrain, the Shiite masses, the supermajority, suffer under a Sunni dictatorship, so-called royal family. And they came out to protest after Egypt and Tunisia. And they said, we don't want to overthrow the king. We're not trying to overthrow the king. We just want a constitutional monarchy. We just want a law that says that, of course, yeah, you're the king and everything. But just that you can't do anything with us, no matter what, like with no accountability at all, because that's not really fair. And you know what happened? Obama sat there and encouraged, at least helped, or, you know, looked away. In fact, I need to go back. I think he even gave the green light for Saudi to send their trucks and tanks across the causeway to the little island nation of Bahrain to help crush that uprising on behalf of the monarchy there. And when his chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Admiral Mullen, was asked on NBC, well, geez, how come we overthrow the dictatorship? We're working to overthrow the dictatorship in Libya, but we back the king against his people in Bahrain. And Admiral Mullen said, well, you see, Bahrain has been a very close ally for many years.
Yeah.
And that's it.
That's the extent of it.
That's where we park our boats. And so he can murder every last man, woman, and child in whatever city he's got. And we don't care about that. And then, so now to Libya. Sorry, I had to work that in there. And these people are the worst fucking hypocrites. It's just unbelievable. But, and then are you telling me that's the end of it? He doesn't talk about what happened in Libya after that?
Yeah, no.
It was a shit show that tens of thousands of people have been killed there since, that the civil war is still raging to this day. As this book goes to print, there's been hundreds of Benghazi-style massacres that we imagine might have happened in the meantime, and they will never be a unified state at peace. They'll never have a parliamentary democracy, and they all curse my graves as they bury their young. And what? Huh?
I was just going to say, he says, almost the last word on it is, but with no democratic traditions or institutions to draw on, the counselors had their work cut out for them, and with Gaddafi's police force no longer in place, the security situation in Benghazi and other rebel areas now had a Wild West aspect. So he mentions the myth of the Wild Wild West, which Terry, I can't think of his name, the Not-So-Wild Wild West by Terry Anderson, I think, refutes that. The long story is, all this chaos is caused by government, and they try to say, you know, this reminds me of when freedom caused a lot of chaos. No. That's a myth.
Same
You're
thing
the
every
real
time.
Chaotic creators. Final words on Libya and the effects of the intervention.
Yeah. Okay. So first of all, he's just lying that Gaddafi was massacring civilians on the way to Benghazi. He wasn't. And he had not vowed to murder every last man, woman, and child in Benghazi. He had vowed only to put down the insurrection. And he was right that the insurrection was led by Al-Qaeda. You know, I don't think he ever said that all the protesters were Al-Qaeda. He was saying, look, and this is a fact that people can read. Alan Cooperman at the National Interest has a great write-up on this, that it was Al-Qaeda fighters, Libyan veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. They were the ones who started this war in Derna at the very beginning of the thing, or not Derna, Dara, sorry, in the far east of the country there, at the very beginning. And he's also did a great job. Alan Cooperman did a great job writing up in the very first place, and he did an extended study of this later, but wrote one up for the Boston Globe. Called False Pretense for War in Syria, in Libya, how there's no indication that Gaddafi was going to massacre the civilians of Benghazi. And then Obama had the nerve to go on TV. He wasn't even in America. He's in Brazil at the time. He announces the war, doesn't even consult with Congress whatsoever. He announces the war on his own initiative. And he lies and he says, imagine the city of Charlotte, North Carolina, 700,000 people wiped off the face of the earth, and every last man, woman, and child in Charlotte, North Carolina, massacred and killed to death. That's what we're preventing by launching this war in Libya. Just an absolutely outright lie. I mean, you couldn't make up a lie about Saddam's nuclear weapons program that was any less honest than that complete pile of crap. And then he knew from the beginning, and look, the war took 9 months, and we knew all along, and this is all in the book, but we knew from the very beginning of the war, these are the Libyan veterans of Al-Qaeda in Iraq. These are the British MI6's pets, the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, Bin Ladenite terrorists, their bosses, leftover jihadists from the Carter, Ronald Reagan, 1980s Afghan jihad. In other words, you know, OG Bin Ladenites from the 1980s and 90s. And these were the same guys whose side they were taking. And no mention there by Barack Obama about the fact that Gaddafi had just signed a deal with George W. Bush to come in from the cold 7 months before. And that he was setting the precedent. You know, I bet you if you ask Barack Obama, how bad does it look that Donald Trump renounced his Iran deal? And how is anybody supposed to trust America's word if any president could just cancel his previous president's agreement? Oh, yeah. Well, what about George Bush shakes hands with Gaddafi, and then Barack Obama shoots him in the side of the head 7 years later. You know, how are the North Koreans or the Iranians supposed to think about Americans and their word after that? You know, it's a miracle the Iranians shook hands with him after that at all. I'm sorry, I forget every single little lie in there, but you see that the biggest lie is the lie by omission, that he doesn't mention really what's happened in Libya in the last 10 years, that he completely destroyed it. The place is an absolute horror show. Tens of thousands of people have been killed. You have foreign intervention where the Italians and the Qataris and the Turks backed the government in Tripoli. And while the Egyptians and the UAE and the Russians back the These are all allies of ours, except Russia, you noticed, right? And the French back the government in Benghazi. We skipped the part, but I'm sure Obama skips the part where his CIA director, David Petraeus, was committing high treason, running guns and jihadist terrorists from Benghazi off to the next war in Syria, which is what got Ambassador Stevens killed. Why was Ambassador Stevens even in Benghazi and not Tripoli? It's because he was helping to run this operation with the CIA, committing high treason on behalf of Osama bin Laden's guys. Just as they're killing bin Laden, they're taking his side. And what's Obama going to say about that? It said, oh, yeah, no, this doesn't have anything to do. I never heard of Ayman al-Zawahiri. This is like that time that we should have saved the Tutsis in Rwanda, see? Or the Hutus in Rwanda. No, the other way around. Yeah. So anyway.
Final question. What was Iraq War 3?
What was Iraq War what? You cut
three.
Out there.
I'm sorry. What is okay. Iraq War 3?
So that's when Obama's support for the terrorists in Syria from 2011 through 2013. First of all, ISIS broke off from Al-Qaeda in Syria. It's kind of a little bit hard to explain, but Al-Qaeda in Iraq from Iraq War II renamed themselves the Islamic State of Iraq at their lowest point when they didn't control a city block. You know, they call themselves the Islamic State. But then once Obama and allies start the war in Syria, then they come up with this new name, Jabhat al-Nusra, and they send the more Syrian part of Al-Qaeda in Iraq back to their home country to start up the war. Well, the war is going great because they got unlimited weapons and money from the Americans and jihadist fighters from all over the region to go and fight. And so in 2013, at the end of 2013, ISIS breaks off from Al-Qaeda and breaks off from Syrian Al-Qaeda, the Syrian dominated faction of Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and says, we're independent and we're creating an Islamic state. And they declare an Islamic state in eastern Syria. Okay, then a year later, they roll into Western Iraq and they conquer all of Western Iraq. This whole time, Obama's still backing the terrorists who are, you know, all the guns and the money and the fighters are going to the worst actors, which are al-Nusra and ISIS. So this was 100% Petraeus and John Brennan's doing and Barack Obama's doing. I mean, they made this happen. And so once they rolled into Iraq and conquered Iraq, then Obama launched Iraq War III in order to destroy the Islamic State caliphate and drive them back out, because it wasn't supposed to be that big and bad, right? They're trying to hurt Assad in Damascus and drive Assad out of power in Damascus. They weren't trying to turn all of Western Iraq into bin Laden's stand, like officially, because that's just embarrassing. And they were happy to see the Shiites under that pressure, the guys that they wish they hadn't fought Iraq War II for. But then eventually they had to come. And then so Obama launched the war in August of 2014, and it ended right around a year later, you know, end of the summer of 2017 was when they finished rousting them out of Mosul and in Western Iraq and Syria and Raqqa in Eastern Syria. And so now, you know, what we call ISIS is just Al-Qaeda in Iraq from Iraq War II. And, you know, again, just the longest story short, there never was Al-Qaeda in Iraq at all until that war. Bush came in and, you know, really created a ground for Al-Qaeda in Iraq to grow into this giant menace. And then amazingly and luckily, almost a miracle, the local Iraqi Sunni population got so sick of their crap that they killed them, and they just marginalized the hell out of them and made them, you know, the Iraqi tribes did, and just reduced their numbers to almost nothing. And then in 2011, Obama comes and puts them right, just resuscitates them right back to life again and puts a bunch of guns and money in their hand to take their war to Syria. And so, I mean, there's just, and it's, to be clear, it's not because Obama's a secret Muslim from Kenya like the right wingers believe. It's because he's George W. Bush. It's because America puts Saudi Arabia and Israel's interests first, and they hate the Shiites more, Iran and Iran's friends, and who benefited especially from Iraq War II. And so now the Americans are trying to make up for that by sucking up to the king of Saudi Arabia, by backing his terrorist forces wherever they are, whether in Libya, in Syria, or in Yemen.
The title of the book is Enough Already, Time to End the War on Terror. Is that correct?
Yeah, the War on Terrorism. Here you go. You see that?
Excellent. Yes. Enough already. Time to end the war on terrorism. Scott Horton, thank you so much for your time as always.
Thank you, Keith. Appreciate it. Bye.